Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Greetings. Welcome to episode 27 of the Silmarillion Seminar. This week we cover chapter 22 of The Ruin of Doriath. My name is Chris Stevens on behalf of the Tolkien Professor and my fellow Silmarillionaires. Surprisingly, we covered a lot of topics in this episode and still managed to finish the chapter in 1 week. Well, we've survived 3 weeks spent on the adventures of Turin Turambar. If you're still with us, without resorting to antidepressant medications, congratulations. I've actually been quite worried about Laura, the intrepid editor of the seminar, since she probably has to listen to them more than anyone. Hang on, Laura, we're almost done. In the current episode, we move away from Turin himself, and we look first at the fate of Húrin and Morwen. The power of the scene of their final meeting and the subsequent death of Morwen generated a fair amount of comment. In addition, we discuss the curious fact that the grave of Turin, Nienna, and Morwen was the only piece of land to survive the sinking of Beleriand. One surprise to me was a great comparison made between Turin Turambar and none other than Master Samwise Gamgee. This discussion gave us a glimpse of Tolkien's attitude on suicide. We then follow Húrin as he indirectly sets the stage for the destruction of the two remaining Elven kingdoms, his plea for help to Turgon and Gondolin, and his bringing the Nauglamir to Thingol and Doriath. Some of the other things we covered: the significance of grave sites in Tolkien's works. We contrasted the corrupting influences of the One Ring versus the Silmarils. And we even had a discussion of Dr. Kevorkian and the supposed euthanasia of Frodo. You'll have to listen to understand. We also discussed Thingol's pride leading to his downfall, the pride that led to his incomprehensible act of berating and antagonizing the dwarves when he was alone and unarmed with them. Then we had a very interesting discussion on Melian's reaction to Thingol's death. I've got a whole new perspective on her motivations, as well as the nature of Thingol and Melian's relationship. And finally, sadly, we covered how pointless and cruel was the attack of the Sons of Fëanor on Doriath. Also how low the sum of the elves had fallen as they left the children of Dior to starve in the wilderness. And now, without further delay, let's join the session.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Silmarillion Seminar. Today we celebrate our first week in a while not talking about Turin Turambar. Oh, well, okay, we're going to talk about the rest of his family for a while here at the beginning, I don't doubt, but we are moving onwards. And of course, the first thing I want to start talking about tonight is exactly that link and connection. That is, we're sort of officially done with the story, which, remember, was called, not just in the recently published book, but even explicitly at the beginning of the chapter, called The Lay of the Children of Húrin. And but of course, we ended that story. That story ends, although it's so long, it ends rather suddenly with just their tombstones and their inscriptions, and then the one brief passing reference to the fact that Nienor's body was not found. Now, of course, at the beginning of the next chapter, right away, we return to Húrin, and his sort of the final tying up of loose ends. And I think it's, one thing which is kind of interesting is where that previous chapter chose to end. I mean, one can see certainly how Húrin's bringing of the Nauglamir to Doriath is clearly part of that follow-up story, is clearly, you know, a big part of the story of the fall of Doriath. But sort of the question of where to end the Turin Turambar chapter is, I think, kind of an interesting one. What did you guys make of that? I mean, as you read the start of this chapter, were any of you sort of, did you have any thoughts about this, about sort of why the chapter break was introduced where it was? Anyone kind of thinking in those directions? I know that many of you had lots of things you wanted to talk about Húrin generally. Brandon, go ahead.
I kind of had a little bit of a thought, because it seems that Morgoth's plan all along wasn't so much the destruction of Turin nor Húrin, but more of like Melian and Thingol. And if you read the beginning of the chapter, it says that Morgoth let Húrin go out of pity, but Húrin was too smart to believe that. And really, Morgoth feared and hated Thingol and Melian's basic goodness, and wanted to destroy him. So I think that's why you get kind of the separation there. I don't know. That's just a thought.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, certainly the focus has shifted, even if, you know, the story that we're telling or that we're hearing at the very beginning seems to be, in a sense, sort of just a logical extension of the previous story. And one could certainly argue that the story of you know, the children of Hurin are sort of the story of the, you know, sort of wreck of the Hurin family doesn't really end until at least Morwen's death, right? I mean, that scene with Hurin and Morwen there at the tombstone, it sort of seems like that should be included, right? It's part of the same story. But I do agree with you, Brandon, that one thing that we can see when we cross over into this chapter is at least some degree of shift towards sort of back to the Elvish point of view. We talked last time some about how this story, the story of Turin Turambar, was kind of fundamentally a human story, possibly the quintessentially human story in the Silmarillion. And so now, you know, of course, you know, we had Elvish characters in it. You know, we had Beleg, of course, and Mablung and Gwyndor, but Thingol and Melian. But nevertheless, they were sort of in relationship to the human characters. It was, you know, they were still kind of, even the important ones, finding they were side characters. However, here we really do get, you know, and now back to Morgoth and the elves, and the way in which Hurin and the ending part of his story works towards that and is instrumental in accomplishing that. So I think that that's a good way to think about it, Brandon, that certainly is a shift that we can see. We do come back to, whereas the focus was entirely in the previous chapter, in the Turin Turambar chapter, on Morgoth and his malice towards Turin, towards Hurin's family in general, now we have back to sort of the big picture. In some sense, that's like, well, I was going to say it's recreational for Morgoth. That's not exactly true. He took personally Hurin's defiance of him, so it was personal in that way, but it's not really strategic. I mean, he's like Dor Loman, it's done. Like, he's, you know, the House of Hador is pretty much finished. And, you know, the fact that Turin, this one really powerful guy, is left wandering around, not a major threat. So strategically, not a big deal. And now we sort of return to the bigger strategic factors. That is, now, you know, we had the wreck of the rest of Beleriand after the Nirnaeth, and we were left with the three Elvish strongholds. You know, so now we've ticked one off. You know, we're down to two. You know, we got rid of Nargothrond last time. Now Doriath and Gondolin are the only ones left, and Hurin becomes at least a little bit instrumental in both of those things. What did you guys make of Hurin's sort of non-encounter with Turgon? I know that in our notes there were several of you who were interested in that encounter, that near encounter, what we see from Turgon's perspective and what we see from Hurin's perspective. Of course, we have to remember, though it's been a long time ago, both in pages and even more in weeks, that Hurin and Turgon have a personal history, two stages of personal history, recall, right? That, remember, Hurin and Huor were taken, were lost in the woods as children, sort of an anticipation of Dior's sons who are lost in the woods, but they're rescued by the Eagles and taken to Gondolin. So remember, Hurin and Huor spend their time in Gondolin and are released by Turgon, so that when Hurin meets Turgon on the battlefield in the Nirnaeth, they recognize each other and they know each other. And then, of course, at that point, then Hurin and his people are the rear guard to allow the Gondolindrim to escape. So that's the context, of course, of his crying out to Turgon. But what do you make of that? Thoughts on his encounter or non-encounter with Turgon? Chris, go ahead.
I guess the thing that struck me, and it's really from Turgon's reaction, I thought it was a little... I would have expected him to be more compassionate, even with the risk of Hurin being maybe brainwashed by Morgoth or whatever. I was surprised that he said, "What was it? My heart is shut," or whatever,
yeah,
whatever it was that he said. And then immediately he changes his mind. That whole sequence just seems, well, strange. I don't know what else to make of it. In my note on the thing, I said something about, is that some sort of destiny intervening in his decision, because things had to carry on as they did. I mean, maybe that was just destined, but I thought his whole reaction and then change of mind was very strange.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I think, and you're right to point out that line. It's to me, I think one of the weightiest lines that we get in that whole section when Turgon says, "My heart is shut," and we'll see in the next chapter that that's gonna play a pretty big part. The policy of Turgon towards the outside world is, I mean, I think it's going to be very important for us to look at when we look at the fall of Gondolin. And we've already seen a couple things already. That is, we saw his discussion with Aridhel, his sister, and his but nevertheless his choice to let her go. We've seen his welcoming of Maeglin and his basically, well, not quite imprisonment, but anyway, his restriction of Eol. And then his letting Húrin and Huor go, and then his opening the Leaguer of Gondolin and marching out, and then returning. So now to see "My heart is shut" is sort of the opposite of the, because the arrival of the Gondolindrum on the battlefield at the Nir-Naith Arnoediad is almost eucatastrophic. It doesn't end up bringing about, it's not like the eagles are coming, it doesn't bring about the sudden victory in the battle, but it is an unexpected turn, and an unexpected good turn. And remember, that's what sort of brings joy and hope to Fingon's heart, kind of, sort of tragically, of
Actually,
course,
it
as it
could have
turns
been
out.
if the men in the east hadn't have intervened,
Yeah.
the coming of the the Gondolin people
Yes.
would have been eucatastrophic, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. Especially since, remember, Turgon was able to restrain them from the rash onslaught that Gwyndor led, and much of the host of Fingon was overextended and then destroyed, but the Gondolindrim weren't. So yeah, they were a big force in the battle, and they and a bit one of the reasons why they might have won. So anyway, this is all in a sense to kind of foreshadow our discussion next week of Turgon, but I do think that moment, "My heart is shut," is really good. Though, to me, even more curious, Chris, sort of thinking about it as a counterintuitive kind of exchange, the conversation between Turgon and Thorondor is Turgon's first impulse. "Does Morgoth sleep? You are mistaken." And of course, Thorondor is a little bit miffed at being accused of being mistaken, that he saw the thing wrong. It's like, no, basically, Turgon seems to actually disbelieve the fact that Húrin is loose. Now, I think that we might in part take this as a testimony of faith in Húrin's character on his part, that he knows that Morgoth's not going to just let him go out of pity, and he obviously doesn't believe what other people believe, or at least is very reluctant to believe it. That is, when they see Húrin coming out of Angband, then they because of his coming out of Angband as one in league and honor with Morgoth, and they think he's gone over to the dark side, and Turgon is obviously so unwilling to conceive of the idea that Húrin has gone over to the dark side, that he is willing to believe rather that Thorondor's eyes were misleading him, and then we see Turgon very grudgingly coming to the conclusion, because it's the only other explanation he can think of, that even Húrin Thalion has surrendered to the will of Morgoth, and that's what leads him to say, "My heart is shut," which I think is really interesting. But Brandon, go ahead.
Yeah, I just found it interesting that you mentioned the eucatastrophic moment of Turgon and Húrin kind of coming together, and eagles sort of having that eucatastrophic, just being there for you to eucatastrophic moments. And in the beginning of the chapter, Húrin looks towards the sky for these eagles that he remembers as a child, as they marked, these eucatastrophic moments, perhaps hope, and they're not there.
Yeah.
All he sees is a fading light and grayness. So I thought that was interesting. Secondly, Turgon, it seems to me that he's one of these beneficent tyrants, where he has, remember, it seems like it's 1%, if that, 1% of the population of Gondolin gets to leave Gondolin. If once you're there, it's so beautiful, it's so spectacular, you don't get to leave. And he kind of rules on that natural hierarchy of political hierarchy. But that's all I have.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's that moment that you say of with the Eagles. I mean, it's this really sad moment, right? When Horan is looking up and it's like, the Eagles aren't coming. The Eagles aren't coming. There's no you catastrophe for Horan, because that would be, in a sense, the only thing that could maybe. I mean, it's not like one can really easily imagine Hurin's story having a happy ending at this point, you know, knowing what he knows and seeing what he's seen. But, you know, if he were to be swept up by an eagle and taken back to Gondolin, that, you know, seems like one of the only things which might be some kind of release, could bring some kind of, you know, to sort of return to that refuge of his youth. You know, to return to the one safe place now in Middle-earth, in Beleriand, but he doesn't get it. And this passage, and Mike, I think that you were mentioning this passage in our notes as well. It's a wonderful description. It's such a powerful sentence. We've talked before about sort of the power of Tolkien's short sentences, and this is one of those long ones. Then Húrin looked up to the gray sky, thinking that he might once more descry the eagles as he had done long ago in his youth, but he saw only the shadows blown from the east and clouds swirling about the inaccessible peaks, and he heard only the wind hissing over the stones. So good, you know, that you've got in place of the eagles, you have the shadows flying significantly, of course, from the east, and the wind hissing over the stones. That is, you know, this sense of deadness. You know, you don't have the green veil of Tomb Laden. This green and fertile plain is what he's thinking about. You've got, remember, Glaurung laying waste to the to everything he comes into. You've just got the bare stones and the wind hissing over it. Makes me think of Gollum's riddle, the wind riddle. Toothless bites and mouthless mutters. Anyway, I think it's this is all in place of the U catastrophe. You know, you just get this barrenness, this emptiness, where the eagle's taking you away to something, something which looks at least a little bit like paradise, might be instead. Turgon, and I think, you know, interesting, and as Brandon, I think you mentioned also, or maybe it was Chris, Turgon's rethinking of this moment, that he, two lines after he said, my heart is shut, he opens his heart again. So this is sort of only a temporary closing of his heart by Turgon, and he sends the eagles to seek for him, and bring them if they might to Gondolin. And again, so he briefly entertained the idea. It seems that Húrin has fallen. It seems that, you know, he has surrendered to the will of Morgoth. But then immediately he's like, let's rescue him instead. But it's too late. And they never saw him again in light or in shadow. In light or in shadow. Suggesting that both of those things are still in Húrin's future, which perhaps we will see. And then you've got his hopeless crying out, O Turgon, will you not hear in your hidden halls? Will you not hear? As if his lack of hearing is a conscious choice by Turgon, you know, that he could hear him if he wanted to, but is deliberately turning a deaf ear to him. It's hard to be Húrin. It really is. But now let's talk about what I know many of you have been wanting to talk about, so I'll be all ready for you guys to jump in, and that is Húrin's final meeting with Morwen. When he meets Morwen at the tombstone of their children, the stone whose inscription ends, essentially, the story of Túrin Túrambar. And I love the fact that Húrin did not look at the stone, for he knew what was written there. Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on how Húrin says after Morwen dies, she was not conquered. It seems that Húrin is implying that the suicides of his children were due to despair, and the courage of his wife to bear it all through to the end was through hope, and therefore more honorable. And I think this is fairly consistent in Tolkien's work, that taking one's life out of despair, such as with Húrin and Denethor, for example, is dishonorable, and that sacrificing oneself for the opposite is good, such as with her in Fifth Vale. And I think that Gandalf, looking back to Return of the King, he says to Denethor, authority is not given to you, Steward of Gondor, to order the hour of your death. And only the heathen kings under the domination of the dark power did thus, slaying themselves in pride and despair, murdering their kin to ease their own death. So I would say that hope is having faith in the bigger picture of Lúvatar, music, and accepting your place in it, and that despair is losing that, instead kind of getting caught up in the current situation and failing to see through it. I guess the moral of the story is that there's always hope, regardless how bad things may seem. And I think that Morwen is, in a sense, she's sort of rewarded at the end for this when Thurin comes and they're reunited. I mean, she's sitting there at the gravesite, and probably the last thing that she's expecting to see is her husband that she hasn't seen in almost 30 years just to magically pop by and say, "Hey, I was let go by Morgoth. Here I am. How you been?" But that's exactly what happens, and it happens right before she dies, which is kind of ironic and really good timing. And I think I agree with Dave that this is one of the saddest chapters in the book. This that moment is just a little bit of light in the saddest chapter. Like it's dismal.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think those are some great points, Nick. And I, you know, the one thing I would say is what the thing that I always find most striking about the initial conversation between Morwen and Húrin is the fact that she doesn't seem surprised. You know, her husband has been captured by Morgoth and held as his prisoner in Angband for years and decades now. And when she looks up and she sees him wandering into the clearing, she doesn't say, you know, "Wow, what are you doing here? How did you escape?" or anything. She says, "You come at last. I have waited too long." "It was a dark road. I have come as I could," he answered. "But you are too late. They are lost." "I know it, but you are not." So it's incredible. But yeah, I agree. The stubbornness of Morwen, you know, I think that you can pair these two, Húrin and Morwen, together. And I think it makes a really interesting comparison to look at, on the one hand, Húrin in the fens of Sarek, surrounded by the armies of Morgoth, shouting, "Day shall come again," as he, you know, wields his axe two-handed, and Morwen sitting there by the grave of Túrin and Nienor, that is confronted by, you know, literally propping herself up against the evidence of their destruction. She knows that they're dead. She doesn't know, like he does, exactly what happens, but she knows that they're gone, and yet her not despairing, you know, her also kind of holding out in this desperate, stubborn strength. The phrase that she uses in response when he says, "But you are not," that is, "You are not lost," she says, "Almost, I am spent." It's been really tiring. You know, it's what she's been doing has been really hard. She has dropped out of the story. Remember, she has been gone ever since Glaurung scattered the group of warriors that came out of Doriath to explore towards Nargothrond. When Nienor lost her memory, we haven't even had a passing reference to her. We don't know what's been happening to her. But, you know, now we find her, and it's as if she has been, she has simply been enduring. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought that Húrin's meeting Morwen, that may have been designed by Morgoth, but the outcome wasn't really what he would intend it to be, because Húrin sees that Morwen is able to escape from the nets of Morgoth, that with her death she's free of his evil fate towards them, the webs of fate that he's woven around them. And so, you know, I think this is one thing that Morgoth sort of orchestrated that didn't quite come out the way he did, but the way he intended. You don't see a lot of real good coming out of it exactly, but it is a moment where you can see that, you know, Morgoth's hold on these people is a passing thing.
Yeah, and Morwen, certainly, whatever we might think, and however we might judge the deaths of Turin and Nienor, as we were discussing last week, surely Morwen, of the four of them, Morwen is the one who sort of dies most honorably, who, you know, if death is an escape, which it certainly seems to be, and I think that Morgoth's language, especially in the Children of Húrin version, really emphasizes that he believes that, you know, he claims to have, you know, control, he claims to be the master of fate, of all things, but he's not, and they do, and mortals do escape him, and all, any possible control he might have. Morwen is clearly the one who, of all of them, escapes most cleanly, and I think that we can see Húrin recognizing that when he says she was not conquered. And you know, Nick, there are still a couple other things that you mentioned that I want to make sure not to pass over. And of course, you're right to peril to bring Denethor in. Of course, Denethor is doubly relevant, both because of course he is he's the most prominent suicide in the Lord of the Rings, and so obviously relevant to this to the question. Not only of Nienor and of Turin, but also, of course, of Húrin himself. But also, of course, you know, Denethor, is also the picture of despair, the clearest exemplar of despair and what it does to you. And the parallels between Húrin and Denethor are very clear. That is, the way in which their vision is warped, the way in which they are led to see all things crooked, the way in which their own wills even become twisted, even though neither one of them submits, though neither one of them gives in. Denethor is still fighting. He hasn't, you know, he's not Wormtongue. You know, he's not betraying his city. He got where he is. That is, Denethor gets to the state that he ends up in by fighting, by resisting Sauron, by daring to look in the stone, in the Palantir, and trying to, you know, wrestling in thought with the Dark Lord up in his tower, as the men in the city say. And yet he sees things crooked, and he doesn't understand things properly. He despairs, and there is pride in that. He is sure that he knows what's going on. And of course, you remember in The Lord of the Rings, the thing that he throws at Gandalf when he is, you know, when he says to Gandalf, "Your hope, thy hope is but ignorance." What he is pointing to is the fleet that's sailing up Anduin, and even now the wind of thy hope wafts from the sea, a fleet with black sails. You know, he takes the arrival of Aragorn's fleet, which looked like the bad guys, because those are the bad guy ships, as evidence of the final end, as evidence of hopelessness. But of course, he is the one who is ultimately ignorant. So again, that's the pattern with despair. That's the kind of thing we see with despair. And you know, we sort of, you know, thinking back to some of the things we were saying with Turin last week, I think that we can see Turin as being a kind of a victim of that similar kind of pride. Not exactly the same, of course, but of him, you know, what he's been struggling with all along is believing that he can be the master of his fate. Anyway, yeah, Brandon, go ahead.
I was just thinking about how it is interesting in the passage where Húrin just he knows that Morwen that she dies without even he just, as you know, it says Morwen sighed and clasped his hand and was still, and Húrin knew that she had died. Mm-hmm. Just kind of like that unspoken sort of awareness that, you know, a person has left this realm. I thought that was just really, it's just a very powerful, powerful scene in Tolkien. I think one of the most powerful.
Yeah, yeah, and his silence, the fact that the last thing she ever says is a question which he doesn't answer, and then she dies, never knowing the answer. Mike, you had some comments on this in the notes. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, my question, and maybe other readers had this question, is her last question, Morwen's last question, "If you know now, tell me, how did she find him?" And is Morwen asking Húrin to tell her how Nienor found Turin?
Yeah, I think so. That's okay. How I take that.
Well, that's how I took it too. So the fact that Horan doesn't respond with the terrible details of how Nanor found Horan, I read that as an act of mercy and compassion and love, and connecting it back to Laura's point about Morgoth's manipulations gone awry. If Horan did act out of mercy and compassion and love in not disclosing that to his wife in the final minutes that they're together, then he spared her the agony of those, of knowing that, and that is a victory. It's a small victory.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that it's an act of compassion, and it is just sort of a fascinating thing, you know, the he is saying something to her in a sense, right? He's like, you don't want to know. She knows what she believes to be the worst, right? She knows they're both dead because she's been leaning up against their tombstone and their names are both of them carved right there. And so she feels like she knows the worst. But he's, no, you don't know the worst. Before we leave the suicide question behind and Nick, again, coming back to one of the things that you were saying earlier, Denethor is not the only suicide moment in The Lord of the Rings. One that I think is really interesting, and I think the moment we were saying it a couple times last time, Dave, you were saying quite forcefully that it's sort of inconceivable that Tolkien is going to be advocating suicide, or that Tolkien would not object to the idea that, like, suicide is a good idea. I think the moment in The Lord of the Rings that I think provides us the sort of the clearest condemnation of suicide is not even Denethor, though that's bad, but Sam, actually, at the end of The Two Towers, when he believes Frodo's dead, he contemplates suicide briefly, and we get a pretty clear condemnation of it there. This is in The Choices of Master Samwise, right as Sam is deciding that he's got to take the ring and go on to the Crack of Doom. He looked on the bright point of the sword. Now, remember, or perhaps you don't remember, but in his fight with Shelob, Sam was compared to Turin. Like, this is, it's one of the two explicit Turin references in all of The Lord of the Rings, is that not even Turin could have stabbed up underneath Shelob and killed her the way that he stabs up underneath Glaurung. So Sam has just been explicitly connected with Turin himself, and then he's looking at the bright point of the sword. Now remember, when The Lord of the Rings came out, nobody had knew the story of Turin, so that wouldn't mean anything to them, but knowing it, it does mean something to us. He looked on the bright point of the sword. He thought of the places behind, where there was a black brink and an empty fall into nothingness. So in two sentences, Sam has contemplated the Turin mode of suicide, and then the Nienor mode of suicide. There was no escape that way. That was to do nothing, not even to grieve. That was not what he had set out to do. "What am I to do, then?" he cried again, and now he seemed plainly to know the hard answer. See it through. Another lonely journey, and the worst. That was to do nothing, not even to grieve. So I said that, in my mind, that paragraph is one of the most sort of succinct and strong anti-suicide moments in The Lord of the Rings. John, I know you had some things that you had wanted to say about Húrin and Morwen as well, and especially this the stone that they're propped up against here. Can you get to the microphone to talk about that, John?
All right. So first, returning to Húrin. What I found very interesting about the Stone of the Hapless, the idea that it's basically the last remaining remnant of Beleriand after the Ward of Wrath, I find quite interesting. I mean, I think you mentioned this on previous podcasts,
mm-hmm.
how of all the objects or relics of Beleriand to survive after the Ward of Wrath, it is very strange that, and yet also quite fitting, that this monument to the children of Húrin yet remains. I think, it's very interesting how this chapter doesn't dive into the ruin of Doriath, though that is its title. It dives directly into, basically, this final little bit about, basically, Húrin, and basically we get what we, you know about the Stone of the Hapless, which I think is really, you know, a monument to them all, and to, you know, to the entire Húrin family. And one element, which I found also sort of neat, is, remember earlier how the chapter about Beren and Lúthien ends, and then we get, you know, of the fifth battle, of the Nir-Naeth Arnoediad. If you stopped and did not read the chapter heading and just continued reading, it would seem like there was no break. I think if you go back to the end of the tale of Túrin Túrambar and basically the beginning of the Ruin of Doriath, just for a little style time, I think it's also it's pretty seamless there, too. I don't know if this was deliberate, you know, because of earlier rough drafts, of course, but it's just one thing I really had in mind. One last thing before we move on is I was wondering, and this is just completely, you know, hypothetical, does anyone really know where the Stone of the Hapless is geographically in Middle-earth? We remember, you know, news about the Dagorath in the last battle. I just feel somehow it has to be tied. It has to be tied in with the very end, as this is almost a relic from the very beginning. But I don't really know, capping off all that we know about Húrin here, whether this was all intended by Tolkien or how much he really wanted left after, you know, he was working on the later drafts of the Silmarillion. I don't think there is any references to this in the Book of Lost Tales. And going through the later writings, I can't tell you about Morgoth's Ring or anything like that. So I just wanted your opinion on these matters, and I'm sorry if I've kind of gotten off the original stage.
Yeah, no. Yeah. That's. I mean, I agree. I certainly agree that you know, the reference to the Stone of the Hapless and Tol Morwen are both of them very, very fascinating. I mean, that paragraph is one of, I think, the most interesting in the entire chapter. Let's actually read it, because there are a whole bunch of individual points, and I want you guys to jump in after this, because I want to do some close reading of this paragraph here. Tell me what you think are sort of interesting elements or moments or phrases or sentences in this paragraph. This is the top of page 230. It is told that a seer and harp player of Brethil, named Glir Húin, made a song, saying that the Stone of the Hapless should not be defiled by Morgoth, nor ever thrown down, not though the sea should drown all the land, as after indeed befell, and still Tol Morwen stands alone in the water beyond the new coasts that were made in the days of the Wrath of the Valar. But Húrin does not lie there, for his doom drove him on, and the shadow still followed him. Now, what's interesting about it? There are a lot of things that are interesting about that. Of course, in some sense, I'm kind of going backwards from some of the larger points that John was making. I think you know, there's definitely a lot there. But I want to sort of go back first and look at some of these details, and then go out to some of those bigger issues. Brandon?
Okay, so the first thing that's really, I think, pretty interesting is that some guy composed a song.
Yeah.
And out of that song grew the power that this would never be touched by Morgoth, and from that it remains. So that must have been a pretty powerful song.
Yeah, and notice the fact that we get his name, Glir Húin. It's completely irrelevant. I mean, we totally talk about stuff that we don't need to know. Right, and this is one of the things that tends to drive people crazy about the Silmarillion, when they get overwhelmed by the names, and they're am I supposed to remember that? Is that going to be important later? No, you'll never hear about Glir Húin ever again. But it's clearly a signal. You don't have to memorize the name, but it does plainly mark the fact that this is a really significant thing, that this song, that this prophecy that he made, he was not only a harp player, but also a seer, was so significant that his name is remembered by those who are telling this tale right now. But yes, I agree. I don't want to get away from the fact, Brandon, as you're pointing out, that this is a song sung as well, and we've seen the power of song before. Laura?
Yeah, I'd say if by this point they're not beaten down by all the names, they're beaten down by the overwhelming depression of this chapter.
Yeah, probably.
But, you know, Tolkien definitely has an emphasis on graves. You know, the one that pops to my mind is the grave of Arwen, which was, it says not, would not be would not be forgotten until the world was changed, mm-hmm. or words to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have to confess that I don't totally understand why just a grave would be so important. You know, I mean, if you think in the Christian religion, it's really not that important. I guess that's more of something that came out of the Norse mythologies. But
yeah, and we certainly get a lot of that kind of that more northern kind of burial mound sort of ethos in a lot of Tolkien's works. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, our burial mounds, you know, and we see some of that too with the Barrow Whites.
Exactly.
You know, burial mounds, are they supposed to still be inhabited by the spirits of these people? Or is it just a physical marker of these people who once lived?
Well, see, that's a really good question. And let's look back. And of course, by the time we get up to the Barrows and the Barrow Whites, we're looking at actually not one, but two different things that is sort of separated twice from where we are right now in the Silmarillion. That is, first of all, those barrows are the burying places of the descendants of the Numenorean, of once the kingdom of Arnor has split and is divided, and the Witch King is up there fighting them and everything. It's their barrows. And then the Barrow Whites are sort of alien to them. We're told that he summons evil spirits who come and live in the mounds and animate things.
Yeah. But it was either Merry or Pippin has the dream about
yes.
the Prince of Cardolan. So,
yes.
You know, maybe the spirit is still there.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly does seem to be some kind of connection there. I mean, that dream, Merry's dream is very suggestive in that way. But the point I was making was that the Barrow White himself is not, I think, the spirit of the Prince of Cardolan that he, whose barrow he's in. But as I say, all of that is pretty far removed from this. In order to contextualize this, we need to contextualize it as much as possible with its immediate context. And we have seen, this is, let's see, unless I'm forgetting, this is our third important gravesite, sort of significant gravesite that a lot of attention has been placed on. That is not only where we get, well, I guess fourth if you count the Hill of Slain after the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, which I suppose we should, actually. It's not an individual grave. It's a mass grave, but right, Brandon is right. Fingolfin's is one. Remember, his body is taken up by the Lord of the Eagles and brought back to Turgon and Gondolin, and Gondolin takes it up and buries him on a mountaintop, and you know, and green grows over the grave, and that's all great. Who else is? So we've got. I will count the Hill of Slain at the end of the Nirnaeth. We've got Fingolfin. Chris, you got it. Finrod. Finrod's, and that one is possibly even more significant than Fingolfin's. That is, it's the emphasis that's placed on it, I think, is even sharper, because of course he is buried on the top of the hill where he first built his city, his tower, Minas Tirith, which is then taken over by Sauron and made evil, and then cleansed by Lúthien, though the burial of Finrod there is the final cleansing moment, and you've got the evil of that island is purged, and it becomes green again, and the grave place of Finrod, none of the orcs dare to come near, and his grave becomes essentially like the second Minas Tirith, like the second Tower of Guard. His grave guards over the passes of Sirion there. So that's great. Now we get Tol Morwen. We'll get at least one more very significant grave place in the next chapter. That is Glorfindel's. But here we get Tol Morwen, and so those, you know, Laura, I'm kind of gradually kind of coming around to your question and observation there. When we're understanding what is the significance, why is this important? I think it's those others that we need to compare it to. Finrod's and Vingolfin's especially, and also the Hill of Slain, one thing that we see is that there seems to be some kind of purification attached with it. All of those grave sites are shunned by evil creatures. And you think even of the way in which Turin self-consciously sets out to make the grave place of Finduilas, the Lady Barrow, as they kind of charmingly call it, a place of dread for the orcs. It seems that they don't naturally shy away from it, but Turin's going to make them shy away from it. But anyway, in general, there seem to be in these important burial places a kind of purification, even a kind of healing, not healing of the dead person, but healing healing of the land, and it seems to be an active force against evil. But we're told something different about Tol Morwen, that it's not just that the orcs will always shun it. We're told even more than that, the Stone of the Hapless should not be defiled by Morgoth nor ever thrown down, that Morgoth himself will be powerless against this. But more importantly, it will go beyond that. It will not ever be thrown down, not though the sea should drown all the land. You know, like in case that ever happens. And of course, it goes on to say it's going to happen. What do you make of this, Laura? Go ahead. You want to follow up on that?
Yeah, is that symbolic of the ultimate victory of death over Morgoth, over evil, and also over just the transitory nature of physical things too?
Well, yeah. See, and that's the thing is that it's the thing I think, you know, basically this also brings us back to the question of why the Children of Húrin is such an important story to the Eldar, not just in the human context, but to the Eldar as well. And it seems a little odd that, you know, if we're right in understanding the story of the Children of Húrin as the sort of quintessential human story, nevertheless, it seems strange that should be, if we're going to take, you know, the Stone of the Hapless, the tombstone of Turin, Nienor, and Morwen, she's on there too, because Húrin carves her on the stone. If we're going to take their tombstone as the memorial of Beleriand, I mean, it is the last remnant of the First Age. In what sense is that appropriate? Because, you know, the First Age is really very elf-centric. I mean, I know we've talked many times about how this story is an elf-centric version of it, but really, by any standard, the elves have been the primary players in the First Age. That is certainly between the elves and the humans. I think that it's in that way a little bit counterintuitive. You know, you'd think if there's going to be a memorial of the First Age, I mean, if there's one sort of central core of the First Age, it's got to be Beren and Lúthien's story, right? Not Turin's story. You know, you'd think that there would be some monument of the union between elves and men, which is, you know, which achieves its fulfillment. You know, its greatest and sort of most transcendent beauty in the story of Beren and Lúthien and their triumph over Morgoth and everything. You'd think that would be the one that would be the memorial. You know, if there's going to be one take home from the First Age, it'd be that, right? But no, it's not. It's not. Nick?
Yeah, just a quick comment. Am I right in saying that the heathen races of man were some of the only people that burn their dead consistently, and that they were aligned with Morgoth in comparison to this?
That the heathen... Wait, say, I lost you a little bit in the middle there. Could you say it again?
The heathen races of men, those that are aligned with Morgoth. Am I right in saying that they were the only ones that consistently cremated their dead?
Well, let's see. I don't want to... I think that seems to me like it would be slightly overstating the case. We do find those races of men which do become corrupt or are easily susceptible to corruption, just as appears to be the case in the Third Age. You know, you've got all those Easterlings who apparently have all fallen under the sway of Sauron, which, so it kind of seems in the human demographics of Middle-earth in the Third Age, the subgroups of humanity who are resisting Sauron appear to be deviant, basically, compared to the majority, the Haradrim, the Easterlings, that you know, the, coming under the sway of Sauron seems to be what's normal. And so in that sense, I think that we kind of can say that, but I don't think it's quite right to say that other than the three kindreds of the Edain that we see in Beleriand, we can kind of assume that all the rest of humanity is actively serving Morgoth. They are ignorant. I mean, the one thing that you can say about them is that they don't know anything about the Valar or Iluvatar. They might have heard rumors. They might have formed, myths that, you know, and stories which may be sort of variously accurate or confused. We know that the learning, the true learning of the Edain, which comes from the elves, which comes from the Valar, is different. And, you know, unlike anything that other men had or have. But I don't think necessarily evil. And one of the things that I guess I would point to would be examples like, for instance, the Breemen. We're told that the Breemen have been in that area for a really long time, you know, for millennia. And they're just like, they were always minding their own business, and they're still kind of minding their own business. They're not, there seems to be certainly at least potential for plenty of people just to be kind of carrying on and not, you know, like we serve the evil mastermind and worship Satan, as many of the rest of them do very actively. Joe? Oh, wait, no, Joe didn't want to talk. He wanted to enter the room. I was like at the wrong little dialogue box there. Welcome, Joe. sorry, my mistake. But yes, I think that this is, it makes, you know, coming back to the stone of the hapless, the two other things that I would point to, there are two other, close reading elements, is what this monument is called in the two times it's named. I think both times are really significant and really interesting, especially in the context of the Turin Turambar story. This gravesite is called two things: the Stone of the Hapless, which means the unlucky, the unfortunate. Hap just means luck. The Stone of the Unlucky, the Stone of the Hapless, and Tol Morwen. Tol means island. So after the land is drowned, and all that's left is the Stone of the Hapless, it is called Tol Morwen, the Island of Morwen. So what do you guys make of, first, the fact that the three people who are collectively, whose memorials are carved on this stone, are called the Hapless? And secondly, why the island is named not after Turin, Mr. Me of 100 names, nor of Nienor, but of Morwen. Those are, I think, both of them interesting and sort of suggestive things. Brandon, go ahead.
Can I answer something before, comment
sure,
something
sure.
Right before that? The unlucky suggests a lot, because if they're unlucky, then therefore the Elvish must have some kind of concept of luck or chance, and therefore don't have a kind of idea of divine providence that perhaps men do. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it does kind of suggest. I mean, certainly the Lord of the Rings kind of trains us, you know, whenever we see luck or chance to add, you know, or so it's called afterwards.
Exactly.
And I don't think necessarily that we need conclude that this means that the elves don't understand about that. I mean, I guess another way you could kind of paraphrase it is like, you know, the stone of those people who were really totally hosed by their destinies there. Dave, what were you going to say?
I was going to give a more cynical answer. I was going to say that the elves were being kind. I personally think we've covered this kind of talking about Turin Turambar, how he's mentioned, Elrond mentions him in a list of great men, Húrin, Túrin, Beren, and then, of course, Frodo. And I kind of think that this is another example of the elves being sort of overly kind. They're like, well, let's name it after Morwen, who's who really bears minimum responsibility for the set of events that took place in all the events described in Turin. I feel like, I mean, maybe you could argue that when she makes her early decision where she sends Turin to Doriath and doesn't go with him, that she bears some responsibility. But other than that, I think she was pretty blameless. And so maybe the elves were thinking, well, if this is going to be a lasting monument, let's name it after the person whose fault it was least. Like I said, this is a
pretty cynical reading,
completely cynical answer, but I think it's fair to bring up at least.
It's like, well, Morrowind doesn't get any props. So let's, what the heck, let's name it after Morrowind. What do you think, Laura?
Well, I had just maybe a slightly different interpretation of the name, the hapless, meaning the luckless, that... You know, they didn't get any of that intervention by Iluvatar. They didn't have any luck at all. Not that it was necessarily bad luck, but that they just didn't have that intervention by Iluvatar. They were more or less sort of let go by any intervention of a higher power to help them. So I guess that's a little bit different than saying they had bad luck, that they just didn't have any luck.
The hapless. It's not the stone of the unfortunate. It's of those who were completely without hap. It's interesting. I mean, certainly things, you know, as we talked about last week, things do not come around for them. And for Morrowind, again, I think it's, you know, to me, I kind of would take it, you know, coming back to Dave's point, I think it kind of gives some significance to the victory that Morrowind achieves. You know, you've got, she seems like an add-on. I mean, she's literally an add-on on the stone. I mean, this is the stone that's erected for Turin and Nienor, and Húrin comes and he's like, plus Morwen at the bottom. But she's the one who conquers. And, you know, and I sort of wonder, you know, if in a sense, if the story of the Húrin family is the most indicative of sort of mortal suffering and what it's like to be in Arda Mard, Morwen is in the end, not, as you say, Laura, not always necessarily from the beginning, but at the end, she's definitely the one who is sort of being the best example. Matt, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I think, you know, you can't even characterize it that the Húrin and his family cause a downfall of these elves, because, I mean, this is ultimately the doom of the Noldor, which they brought on themselves, and these poor unwitting humans have been become a catalyst to bring down their downfall, or instruments of their downfall, and they've kind of got swept up in this whole giant story of the downfall, the diminishing of the elves, and in that way, they've been punished just as much by the actions of the Noldor previously, which led to the doom of Mandos.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, and there is certainly a sense in which they've been caught in the crossfire here, you know, that they are, that, you know, you think of the discussions that the humans had right after they came into Beleriand, and the debates, you know, like, hey, why do we want to get involved here? You know, we've come here and because we thought it was nice over here and we were getting away from the darkness, and now we find that actually we're going to be cannon fodder, so let's get the heck out of here. So, yeah, I mean, this seems to be, in one sense, you could see the response of the elves to the story of Húrin and Morwen and their family as being almost like a recognition of that. You know, this is, and again, that kind of brings me back to that parallel between Morwen's long and solitary vigil at the gravesite of her children and Húrin's stubborn resistance in the Fens of Serek. Yeah, I mean, I think that we can see them being, in that sense, victims, and this sense in which, you know, they were, you know, victims beyond their own, you know, beyond their own intentions and their own understanding. Okay, we should. For those of you who are despairing that we're going to get through this chapter this week, we totally are. Even if you look at our discussion notes, like more than half of it was on Hurin and stuff at the beginning. So I knew that we had a lot to say about this, and I wanted to talk about this a lot. But let us move on to the Doriath section, which actually is in some ways, I think, kind of simpler. Matt, did you have something that you wanted to add before we went off to Doriath?
I mean, yet this was just an interjection aside from the general discussion. One point I wanted to make was I've read many times over the years that many modern fantasy writers kind of write, their writings tend to be real dark in tone and everything, and I've often heard the comment that this might be kind of in response to those writers kind of not appreciating Tolkien and just wanting to get away from what they thought was a fantasy that was too pretty and too much a good and evil type thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that these people may never have read the Silmarillion.
Yeah, I think that that's true. Of course, some of them, when they talk about the Lord of the Rings, you wonder if they've ever read that. But yeah, no, I think it's pretty safe to say that they certainly don't seem to have thought too much about the Silmarillion in any case. I think that that's perfectly fair. If anyone is ever tempted to think that, you know, that Tolkien is too everybody lives happily ever after, I mean, again, I don't know how you can even come to the last chapter of The Lord of the Rings still thinking that in Frodo's departure, but anyway, yeah, certainly nobody's going to read these chapters and still be thinking that. So on to Doriath. We have Hurin's final confrontation with Meme, and Hurin finally not having mercy on Meme. Meme attempting a third time to pay off somebody who he thinks is going to kill him, and Hurin having none of it. And then he takes the Nauglamir. Now, a couple of you were sort of interested in asking about, what the sort of the evolution of this story is, and sort of the connections with the Book of Lost Tales, and you know, sort of how this story came about. It's really complicated. This changes a lot from the Book of Lost Tales. One thing I want to come back to is basically the role that the Silmaril plays in this. It's one thing that's most striking when you read the Book of Lost Tales version, you know, it's the very first version of this part of the story. The Silmaril is actually a pretty minor character. What ensnares Thingol and what brings about the destruction, what leads to the feud between Thingol and the dwarves, and what brings about the destruction of Doriath is not the his and the dwarves' coveting of the Silmarils. It's the horde of Nargothrond. In the original version of the story, Hurin, who's called Urin, he first of all has a gang of men with him that he has kind of picked up in the wild, like Turin did, and they like put the as much of the gold as they can possibly carry from Nargothrond into, you know, bags and boxes and wheelbarrows and backpacks and haul it to Doriath, and then they and the elves fight over it. I mean, and they shed their blood on the they take it from Meme, and Meme curses it, and then they take it, and then they fight with the elves of Doriath over it, and the elves of Doriath kill most of them, and then so it's cursed. The gold is cursed three times, cursed by Glaurung, cursed by Meme, and then cursed by the blood that shed over it when it's seized, ultimately, by Thingol and his people. So the curse of the gold, and especially of Meme, actually. Meme is a much more important character in the original version of it.
And his curse is very powerful. So basically you've got this cursed gold, and that's what keeps causing all of these problems, and that's ultimately what leads, it's his decision. The Melian character, Melian does not yet have that name, and her name changes lots of times during the first draft of this story. But anyway, the Melian character is still not being, or is already not being listened to, and she says, "This gold is bad news, throw it in the river," and Thingol first says, "Okay, yeah, we'll do that," and then he decides not to. You know that, you know, there's this other guy who's like, "Oh, but don't you really want to keep the gold?" And Thingol's like, "Oh, well, okay, actually, yeah." Anyway, so that's what brings it about. I think that the shifting of the focus, sort of the bringing about of the tragedy from this cursed gold of Narga, this thrice cursed gold from Nargothrond, to the Silmaril. Is really fascinating because, you know, the heritage there is that the stuff itself, the gold itself, is bad news. It is damaged goods. It is, if you try to get it, it will destroy anybody who tries to keep it because it is so thoroughly cursed. The Silmarils, though, as we'll remember, are hallowed. They're sacred. They're holy. They burn unholy hands that touch them. So I think that, you know, that's a really fascinating shift, I think. Just looking at this story, what do you make of the Silmaril and the role that the Silmaril plays? And I'm not yet thinking about the Sons of Feanor here, just Thingol and the dwarves. What do we do with this? How do you read Thingol's relationship with the Silmaril? We've had other references, of course. That is, we've seen Thingol refusing. He refuses first to yield up the Silmarils to the Sons of Feanor when they demand it. You remember at the beginning of the chapter, right after the end of the story of Beren and Lúthien, at the very beginning of the Nir-Naithar Nordiad chapter, he refuses to give it up. And now we see him really focusing on it. What do you make of this? I mean, are the Silmarils just bad news? I mean, are the Silmarils like the cursed gold? Is there just a curse on the Silmarils? They bring about the destruction of everything? I mean, what do you think? Yeah, Joe, go ahead. I think you might as well talk about that. Well, here, Matt first, and then okay, we finally got some volunteers here. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think that in general, anything precious and unique and one of a kind seems to, I think that what's happening here, it's the greed for that thing that is the curse, not the thing itself. They lose sight of what the thing might be, what its power might be, what it might be good for, and get absorbed in actually the possession of the thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I think that's the most important effect of the shift. It is the curse that is laid upon the gold that makes stuff happen, including, for instance, explicitly, Beren is able to defeat the king of Nargothrond in their final duel in the river, because just as Beren is going to lose, or he might lose anyway, and the dwarf, the king of the dwarves, is about to aim his final killing blow, but then the curse strikes him, and his foot slips on a stone, and he falls over. And this, I mean, again, it's like it is because the curse comes up and bites him that he gets into that trouble. Whereas here, as you say, Matt, the shift is from the, it's not the stuff, it's not the curse, it's on the stuff that's causing events. It's the choices that people make, it's how people respond to it. Dave?
Well, as usual, you jerk stole my point. but I was going to say a variation of what you guys just said, that I think the problem lies not in the object, but in the people that are possessing it. Which is distinctly different from the ring. I remember the first time I read this book, I found myself constantly going to that comparison. Like, the Silmarils are like the ring, you know, the central artifact of the Silmarillion. And I tended to think of them as serving a similar role to the ring. But they really don't, because I really think that the Silmarils themselves, it's almost sort of like, this is like a bizarre sort of metaphor for the old saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You know what I mean? Like, the Silmarils themselves are good things. The light
in them is good. Like, the pursuit of them is like the pursuit of the good, and yet you see evil consequences coming of it anyway, because the people pursuing it are not, in and of themselves, maybe it's not that they're not good. They are, some of them are good, but they're still imperfect. But what's interesting is, what makes the Silmarils really different from the Ring in this sense, and boy, I'm really going off on a tangent, but I'm going to keep going, is possession of them is not necessarily evil. It's certainly, possessing it is certainly not particularly good for Morgoth or for Thingol. But on the other hand, when you look at how they describe, and I'm jumping ahead now, but when you look at how they describe the effect of the Silmarils on Luthien when she possesses them in the land of the dead that still live, they describe how it had plenty and bounty and good, you know, unlike anything that came afterward during the time that they had it. And certainly possessing the Silmaril was good for Elwing and for Arendil, because it helped them open, you know, or at least we're led to believe it helps them open the passage to the west. And so I don't think there's a curse on the Silmarils. Maybe there's a curse on everything else, all the other treasure, on the Nauglamir later and things like that. But I think the Silmarils remain good, and that it really ends up being the people around them that bring about bad consequences. And maybe that's the curse of the Noldor in effect, or maybe it's just, you know, imperfect people acting badly. But it is interesting that folks who come into possession of them in sort of a bad way, Morgoth and Thingol and later the Sons of Feanor, tend to suffer bad consequences because of them. Folks who possess it for short periods of time, you know, but not actually desiring it, like Beren and Luthien, don't suffer too many ill points or ill effects. So there's something very interesting going on.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think that last point especially I would emphasize. Beren and Luthien are possibly the least possessive of all Silmaril holders in the whole story, because for them it was never about the Silmaril, it was about each other, and the Silmaril was only a means to an end. On the one hand, it was their great and high destiny and Beren's doom and all that, but really it was never actually about the Silmaril for them. And for Thingol, you're right to point out that his... You know, we think about, even thinking about the kind of language that Gandalf uses talking about Bilbo finding the ring, you know, how his possession of the ring starts, the frame of mind in which it started. Well, the frame of mind in which Thingol acquires the Silmarils is pretty bad. And remember, Melian points this out to him immediately, you know, that you have brought, you know, that you have doomed yourself, she says. You have doomed either your daughter or yourself. So she says right away, if you get a Silmaril, like, it's curtains for you. That's it. So he is... Now we saw at the beginning of the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, when he refuses to give up the ring, or not the ring, listen to me, when he refuses to give up the Silmarils to the Sons of Feanor, he cites some good motives, like, oh, you know, Beren and Luthien, like, I'm just doing it because I'm remembering Beren and Luthien, and, like, you know, they were, it's not about the Silmaril or anything, you know, it's about, like, what Beren and Luthien did. But we can see that's sort of a little bit of rationalization on their part. Now, it might seem perhaps that I am disagreeing with you, Dave, and paralleling the Silmarils and the Ring again, but you're right to differentiate the two of them. The Silmarils don't have the kind of corruptive influence directly upon their holders. If they bring out bad things in people, it's because what they are is like that which is quintessentially beautiful and good, and therefore desirable. And it's that desire which is sort of the touchstone for people. But go ahead.
It seems to bring out the ring itself. The ring brings out bad in people who possess it as much as it does in people who desire it. Mm-hmm. So even Bilbo keeps it for a long time, and it starts to corrupt him.
Right.
The Silmarils, really, the only people that really seem to... you know, I mean, you could argue that it shortened the lifespan of Beren and Luthien, but it really, like, it's people who are going about trying to acquire them those are the people that really suffer from, or they don't directly maim or harm or corrupt or hurt anyone except people who are already evil. So like Morgoth and the Sons of Feanor and those sorts of people. Like when, you know, Thingol's possession of it isn't particularly good, and yet at the same time, it's not like they made him steadily more evil or anything. That the pride that he demonstrates at the end with the dwarves is pride that was always there. He was like that with Beren before he even had a Silmaril. So
yes.
I think they're quintessentially different. Although one thing I would point out, one way in which they are certainly similar is that you know, when somebody happens to acquire them or come into possession of them under good circumstances, let's say Bilbo in the Ring, let's say Beren and Lúthien in the Silmaril, the people that they hand them off to are to generally end up paying the price. Frodo gets screwed over with the Ring. I mean, his life's pretty much ruined. And then, let's see, Beren and Lúthien give it to Thingol, and then he ends up dying and his kingdom's destroyed. And then Beren and Lúthien go and get it back, and then they give it to their son Dior, and then he dies and the kingdom gets destroyed again.
Doesn't turn out so well.
I mean, if anyone ever walks up and says, "Would you like a Silmaril?" your answer should be no.
Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah. Though, of course, also, if you're sitting there saying, "Boy, I really want to get a Silmaril no matter what," that's also not very, that's also not a very good sign either. Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. Laura, I get the sense that we've been saying a lot of the things that you wanted to say, but I'll let you jump in here too.
yeah, but you guys said it so well. You said it better than I ever could, so that was okay. But I did want to point out one thing that's different and interesting to me about the Silmaril and the Ring, in that the Silmaril, when mortals have it, when Beren and Lúthien have it, they die quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ring extends your life to the point that it's meaningless,
yes.
You know, like with Gollum.
Yes.
That's what it does to mortals. And I thought that was kind of an interesting contrast, that the Silmaril, which doesn't really have any power in itself other than beauty, and that's about it, and the Ring, which is this bad thing and does have power, you know, the one shortens your life and the one extends your life. So I guess what Tolkien is saying there is that, you know, long life is not necessarily a good thing,
right?
Especially for a mortal. But you know, this short period of absolute beauty unlike that had ever been seen outside of Valinor, is a good thing, even if it is a short thing.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, of course, you've got Gollum, and then you've got the Ringwraiths to show what happens to mortal people who have it. And in this sense, you know, one major difference, in addition, as you say, to the corruptive power, you know, the evil power of the Ring, which the Silmarils don't have, the Silmarils are an end in themselves to some extent, whereas the Ring is a means to an end. The Ring is a means to power, and also a means to immortality for mortal creatures. And when you're using the Ring as a means to either one of those ends, it's very bad, and it corrupts you, and it sort of amplifies the corruption that those desires already represent. And as you say, it is obviously based upon the outcomes, it's obviously inappropriate for mortal creatures to be attaining immortality in this kind of you know, sort of sick and half-hearted way. Half-hearted, that's not quite right, is it? But yeah, the lives, so their lives being shortened is, in a sense, not necessarily a bad thing. I would say, I mean, for clearly the closest parallel that we have to the sort of premature death of Beren and Lúthien is Frodo. You know, Frodo is going to die very soon. When he, at the end of the story, he goes to Valinor, you know, he's taken overseas to find healing, but he's mortal, and he's gonna die really soon when he goes over there.
Yeah, and that death was really a blessing to him. I mean, he was expecting, as you said before, expecting to die. He didn't die, and his life had become a burden, and so that death, in amongst such a bliss, was ultimately a blessing.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. I mean,
Dr. Kevorkian.
No, this is not. This is what. Well, I guess like euthanasia by like.
I can't resist interjecting, but when you put it that way, when you say like, well, he was on his way out and he was going to suffer greatly, and they decided to take him over there where, and of course the elves had to have known that the bliss would burn him out and make him die sooner. How is that not euthanasia? Well, we'll kill him earlier than he would otherwise die, but he'll feel better during that time.
The question.
It's. I'm being a little facetious, but only partially. Sometimes when I think about that, if any of those elves had foreknowledge of what would occur, it is a strikingly very similar situation to what we think of as euthanasia. It's kind of bizarre. Just wanted to toss that in.
I hear that. Laura, go ahead. Laura, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah. Dave, the only reason I didn't interrupt you is because I know how hard it is to edit that out. So, but you know, I wasn't saying that it was like suicide. You know, I was saying that, you know, Frodo had these wounds that, you know, I don't believe were even fully healed over in Elvenholm. And the only release for him was death. I mean, I'm not saying, and that's true of every mortal person. You know, there are some things that just don't heal, and in some cases, death is a blessing. That doesn't mean you're going out and, you know, advocating suicide for people, but just the chance for him, for Frodo to be as happy as he could be in those last years of his life. I think that was the point of the elves bringing him over there, not to extend his life, but, you know, that he could be happy for that last amount of time that he did have.
Well, and I mean, you can see it as a parallel to, again, instead of thinking of Dr. Kevorkian, we could think about Aragorn, essentially, and his rendering up of his life willingly when he had come to its end. Frodo is maimed. Frodo is not well. Frodo is dying when he leaves the Shire. He finds healing. He is blessed with healing and peace. How much sooner did he die than he would have died? I don't know. But he is the attitude that apparently Frodo adopts towards his own mortality at the end, because he accepts it, is, I think, more like, it's not like, to go back to something that we didn't talk about yet, it's not like Húrin's death, where Húrin would live no longer, and, you know, he wouldn't live and casts himself into the sea. And that's different from Frodo, I think. You know, from Frodo's going in, both of them go in the sea to the west, one with a boat and one without. But I think that that's... That, I think, is the really important contrast there. There's a huge difference between seeking death or, you know, fleeing life and accepting death. Again, Aragorn doesn't commit suicide, but he lays himself down and dies. And I think that is the idea. I mean, Aragorn's death, I think, is pretty clearly held up to us as the mortal ideal. Like, this is the attitude you're supposed to have towards death. This is the attitude that people had towards death before death was corrupted, before, you know, the shadows and lies of Morgoth surrounded it. But Joe, as our euthanasia debate has been raging, you've been very patient. Let me let you get in here.
Yeah, it's all right. I'm backtracking a little bit now, but relating back to the Nauglamir making it into Doriath, I just thought it was interesting because you saw it make it in there, and it seems like it was of numerous things. The most obvious seems to be the curse of the Noldor. I mean, I don't know exactly why Húrin went to Nargothrond. I can't really remember, but he just comes out with this most beautiful thing that happens to capture Thingol's mind, and he'll say, oh, I'll put this together with the Silmaril, and the dwarves get involved, and then there's death and all kinds of sad things happen from it. But it's just the chain of events that happen from that, it's crazy. But it doesn't seem like it's only the curse of the Noldor, because I mean, what led him to do that was the curse of Morgoth, and I mean, and also how it all ties in and it all wraps up to something crazy in the end. I mean, some better things happen, and you can almost go back to the beginning and saying
you know, evil be good to have been, and things like that.
But yeah, no, I mean,
just a
yeah.
You can it's interesting. Sorry.
No, I agree, and I think that that's you know, that kind of brings me back again to something we were also talking about last time, which is, you know, when we were thinking about Turin and especially Glaurung, and asking, you know, what's Glaurung's plan? What's Morgoth's plan? I mean, really, did he actually foresee and orchestrate the meeting of you know, like naked and no memory Nienor with Turin, and that's like that was actually consciously the plan? Maybe, as we said, we can't rule that out completely. But I think with Hurin's release, we see some pretty clear example that Morgoth doesn't necessarily foresee all that. He lets Hurin go not with a specific strategy, you know, not like, okay, I know exactly how Hurin is going to facilitate the destruction of Doriath, but it seems at the beginning pretty clear that Morgoth is just letting him go because he's like, hey, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Basically, he can only do harm at this point. So let's let him go and see what happens. And then he's sitting back there and he's like, oh, he's revealed the region of Gondolin. Okay, check. That's a good thing. And now he ends up doing this other thing. Oh, great. You know, so we'll let him screw things. We'll just leave him on his own to screw things up, which does kind of lead one to suggest that, like, when Glaurung does not kill Turin the first time and lets him go and sends him off on the wrong path, you know, that it does kind of seem that that's almost like the release of Hurin, that what he's really doing is saying, hey, man, you know, these mortals, you know, if I just wind them up and let them go, you know, bad stuff's going to happen, which is all going to be good. So, or that is good from Morgoth's perspective. You know, Dave is still furiously carrying on the euthanasia argument in the text chat here. Dave, would you like to come back on with this, or are you and Laura taking it outside at this point? What's going on here?
No, I've sidetracked us too long. There's no chance of finishing this chapter if we don't get back on track.
Oh man, we're almost done. What are you talking about? Okay, so and by the way, you're totally finished.
I don't know. I think we probably need another week.
I knew you would say that, but no. Okay, so back to Thingol then. Let's look at Thingol's final confrontation with the dwarves. And I think that Matt was right to say that we definitely need a reading of Thingol's last and rather unfortunate speech that he makes there to the dwarves. What do we think about that? Let's see. First question actually would be, where is that? I think I skipped the page there. The dwarves, okay, right, 233, right, okay. Yep, there we are. Okay, volunteers, who would like to read it? Matt, you want to go?
I'm sure I'll do it. Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Okay. How do ye of uncouth race dare to demand aught of me, Elu Thingol, lord of Beleriand, whose life began by the waters of Quivievan, years uncounted ere the fathers of the stunned people awoke? This seems to be a recurring theme here. It's like as soon as the elves and the dwarves have a disagreement, the elves just go nuclear with their, you know, just dissing the dwarves and just, you know, mocking them.
Yeah. Of course it's very similar. The tone of it is very similar to his speech to Beren, of course, at the beginning of Beren and Lúthien. Thingol looked upon Beren in scorn and anger. Who are you that come hither as a thief and unbidden dare to approach my throne? What would you here, unhappy mortal? And for what cause have you left your own land to enter this which is forbidden to such as you? Can you show reason why my power should not be laid on you in heavy punishment for your insolence and folly? You can see a very similar tone there. Laura?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if anybody else throws out these unwarranted insults like Thingol does. I mean, he just really throws them out there. You know, he just has scorn for everybody lesser than he, and it's a good thing Melian didn't have that kind of scorn for him when they got together.
Who are ye who just awoke by the waters of Quivienin? Yeah, no, exactly. She could have taken that line. No, I think that that's definitely a good point. Well, one thing to remember, he's not the worst. Remember that Carinthir used to hunt the dwarves when he first saw them, not even apparently realizing that it's that it's, you know, that they're like sentient creatures, and then it's like, oh wait, you know, they actually speak and are rational. We should probably not just kill them out of hand. But remember Karin Thir's scorn for the unloveliness of the dwarves. So I mean, we have seen, you know, so in some ways we see, you know, the, you know, dark Karin Thir, of the Sons of Feanor having an even more pronounced scorn than Thingol does. Thingol at least repents of it, at least as far as humans are concerned, he repents of it after, you know, so he's kind of taking back his words to Beren. He doesn't get a chance to take back his words to the dwarves. But obviously, this is not just an expression of Thingol's character, but obviously an expression of the pride which he is already exercising, which he's already, well, exercising, perhaps not quite the right word, you know, which he is also demonstrating through his attachment to the Silmaril, right? I mean, it's not difficult to see the connection of those two things, that just as he is sort of being possessive and focused on the Silmaril, that he's thinking a lot, you know, his thoughts have turned inward and towards himself, and now he is completely oblivious to even his own situation. I mean, he's so, his self-image is so altered now, by the way that the pride which has been gaining in him through his contemplation of the Silmaril, has been, you know, his own self-image is so changed that he now completely underestimates his situation. Like Feanor himself, of course. Remember Mr., like, I'm gonna go sack Angband by myself, and, you know, gets killed by the Balrogs. So yeah, I mean, I think that we can see that pretty quick. Of course, there's also the sort of the delightful irony that Thingol gets killed by the dwarves. It is emphasized that he is the tallest of all of the children of Ilúvatar. I sort of imagine, at least I always imagine, the dwarves kind of chopping him down at the ankles. One thing I would say about Thingol here is that Thingol is, he does really, you know, admittedly sound like a jerk in that speech, and we can see this as part of a pattern of pride which has existed in him all the way through and has been growing in him of late. Tolkien changed this story in ways which were actually really quite pro-Thingol. Thingol is much more shallow and a much bigger jerk in the Lost Tales version of this story, where he, first of all, the back and forth thing between him and the dwarves and their negotiations of, you know, what they're going to get paid and everything, is he is very high handed. He's petty. He's a sharp dealer. He just does not look tragic and grand in any way. The Thingol in this, of course, his name isn't Thingol yet in the Book of Lost Tales. It is Tinwellint. Tinwellint is a smaller character. I mean, in almost every dimension, smaller. He doesn't have the stature of Thingol, either physical or sort of spiritual. But here, this is sort of this one lapse, right? This one blindness that he is great, but he's been led into this blindness by his pride, and expresses that pride and that blindness in this one moment, not even realizing, you know, hi, I'm in danger here. I am outnumbered. Even though I'm, you know, Mr. Awesome Elven King, I am in fact, unarmed in the midst of potential enemies whom I'm now going to mock and yell at. But anyway, I mean, I think that it is, I think, interesting that the changes that Tolkien does make, I think, are basically to elevate Thingol and to make him, in a sense anyway, more of a tragic figure here, I mean. But what do you make of Melian, though? I mean, apart from the fact that still nobody is listening to her, what are your thoughts about Melian and her role in this chapter, or lack of role in this chapter? Laura?
Well, I'm surprised she didn't say, I told you so. I've been trying to tell you these things, but nobody listens to me.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was her response after Thingol's death was interesting. And I sort of wondered if she regretted her choice to marry him, and you know, take a body that was tied, you know, more like an elven body than she had before. And you know, I wonder if her. It says she went back to Valinor to go to the gardens of Lorien and to ponder her sorrows. But you know, I just wonder if she's pondering the sorrows of being married to Thingol, if she would have done things differently. You know, if she was wanted to be closer to him. I don't know. I just felt like there was a little bit of regret in Melian after Thingol's death.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's hard. I certainly don't think we can take that too far. That is, I mean, I think if we, especially with all of the Thingol bashing that has been going on for months in this seminar, you know, we can kind of, we might be able to work ourselves into a place where we convince ourselves that Melian's response certainly would be, you know, like free at last when Thingol is dead. But I certainly don't think that the text gives us much excuse for thinking in that direction, for thinking quite so far as that. I mean, what is emphasized is right after his death, what is emphasized about her thoughts is her connection to Thingol and her love for him. Melian sat long in silence, the very bottom of 233. Melian sat long in silence beside Thingol the king, and her thought passed back into the starlit years and to their first meeting among the nightingales of Nan Elmoth in ages past, and she knew that her parting from Thingol was the forerunner of a greater parting, and that the doom of Doriath was drawing nigh. For Melian was of the divine race of the Valar, and she was a Maia of great power and wisdom. But for love of Elwë Singolo, she took upon herself the form of the elder children of Iluvatar, and in that union she became bound by the chain and trammels of the flesh of Arda. In that form she bore to him Luthien Tenuvio, and in that form she gained a power over the substance of Arda, and by the girdle of Melian was Doriath defended through long ages from the evils without. But now Thingol lay dead, and his spirit had passed to the halls of Mandos, and with his death a change came also upon Melian. Thus it came to pass that her power was withdrawn in that time from the forests of Neldoreth and Regian, and as Galduin the Enchanted River spoke with a different voice, and Doriath lay open to its enemies. One parallel that I would... Well, okay, there are a bunch of people waiting to talk. Let me not make my parallel for fear of stealing somebody's thunder again. You guys go first, and then I'll say what I want to say. Chris, go ahead.
Okay, I guess what's always troubled me about Melian at this point, from the first time I read the Silmarillion, it's like she has been the queen of the people of Doriath for millennia, and yeah, she's suffered a tragedy, but she's presumably going to see Thingol again once, you know, maybe a long time in the future, and he's released from Mandos. If she'd have hung around a little while, maybe she could have kept Doriath from being completely destroyed. It almost seems, I know motivations of a Maia might be more complicated than what I'm saying, but it almost seems disloyal to her. She took on the body of an elf, and so she acted as queen for these people for so long. She just pretty much abandoned them when they needed her most. So I guess that's what always troubled me about her actions at this point.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. And I, you know, for years had that same exact reaction. I mean, I remember very clearly thinking that exact same thing when I first read this and thinking, wow, Melian really quit on him, didn't she? I mean, you know, the only reason that the dwarves come in, and the only reason Doriath is sacked in the end is because she's like abdicated. You know, she's like, well, you know, whatever, I'm taking the girdle away and I'm just gonna, you know, y'all are on your own. I don't think that this passage actually suggests that that's the case. I think that there is an alternative to that reading, which this passage gives us. But
again, I agree that her motivations, particularly once she starts getting mentally into the mode of being a Maia again, since she doesn't have Thingol there to kind of anchor her to the elvish world, then her motivations, I think, probably change, and she starts to disconnect I guess I'm reading a whole lot into it. But
well, no, I mean, no, exactly. No, I think that's warranted. But Dave's about to explode, so I'm not going to say anything else. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm jumping in uninvited because I have a. It's not an explanation. It's more of a question. This time around, when I read this. Every time previously that I've read this, I had that explanation too. I was like, well, why the heck did she, you know, like kind of screwed him over. But, this time reading it, I interpret it to mean that the power that she exercises over Doriath was indeed tied to Thingol. That in falling in love with him and then taking on, her fleshly form, that is how she gained the power that she's able to exercise over not Middle Earth, but the particular part of Middle Earth. It's almost like Bombadil. She sort of sets her own bounds.
Right.
But then when Thingol dies, that power is broken. That's how I read it this time. I read it to mean that her relationship with Thingol was indeed the source of the power that she not all her power, but specifically the power, the Girdle of Melian and the power she exercises over the Kingdom of Doriath is tied inextricably to her relationship with him.
Yeah.
That's a great thought, Dave. I guess I hadn't thought about that, but at one point it said that Melian gives Thingol a good share of, lends him her power.
Yes.
And so I think maybe that's maybe the answer. Once he dies, her power reverts to what it was before, in which he doesn't really have the power to extend that girdle anymore. That's an excellent thought.
Yeah, I mean, the two passages I would point out here in this, that is the two bits from this passage that I would point out that support what Dave is saying there is, you know, in that form, she gained a power over the substance of Arda. Gained. If she hadn't assumed that form, if she had not been, if she had not been incarnated in the flesh in the way she was, she would not have had the power to create the Girdle of Melian. And then at the end, that wonderful image, by which Tolkien expresses, with this sort of delightful indirectness, the ending of that power. And as Galduin, the Enchanted River, spoke with a different voice, something has changed. This is not like, and she has just, you know, she's like taking her ball and going home, but that she is, things are different now, and it has been broken. Mike?
Yeah, to Dave's point that, you know, as long as their partnership was intact, they each gave something to the other. One Thingol dies, it seems pretty clear that a large part of Melian's power kind of switches off with a click almost.
Yeah.
And similarly, when Thingol sort of removes himself with the partnership with Melian, the wisdom he has access to switches off with a click. I mean, we've seen him seated in the throne room next to Melian almost exclusively through the whole book. So that proximity and that partnership is emphasized, and she's able to convey her wisdom to him. But in the end, he's described as exclusively sitting, you know, in the workroom somewhere in the Thousand Caves, just watching the dwarves, you know, work on the necklace. So he's abandoned that partnership, and so the wisdom he has access to through Melian is also disabled.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we've sort of seen him kind of cutting himself off from her in his refusal to listen to her sort of progressively over time. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it is like a switch is turned off. And I think that is how we're supposed to be reading that there at the end. The parallel I was going to make that I stopped myself from before, which I'll come back to now, is her Melian's incarnation into fleshly form as she binds herself to Thingol is rather like the Valar entering into Arda. Remember that when some of the Ainur, looking at the vision and seeing, seeing Ea, the land that is, out of love, they descend into it and they bind themselves to it and they are restricted within it and they gain power over it. But it is their love that binds them to it and they become limited. I mean, we talked about this way back in our first two sessions last year, talking about the way in which these you know, these phenomenal cosmic powers restrict themselves to, you know, taking on forms and operating within, you know, this little speck of a planet. Well, Melian has done a similar kind of thing, and it has had a similar kind of effect. And so, in a sense, you know, the end of Thingol's life is like, in this parallel, sort of like the end of Arda. You know, there will come a time when Arda will be done, and when history will come to an end. And at that point, the Valar are going to be released. Their job will be over, and her job is over. Now, again, the parallel is not exact. I mean, I'm not saying that they're the same situations, but I think we can see a similar kind of dynamic going on there with that binding through love and that restriction for the duration of that time, but it's not a permanent change. She goes back to who she was and what she was in her previous relationship with it. We are close to running out of time, but I only have one or two other things that I wanted to talk about. One of the last things that I want to talk about is the Sons of Feanor. What do you guys make of the attack of the Sons of Feanor? I mean, I would say, and I think we have some evidence here to say that this is the worst thing the Sons of Feanor have ever done. In the long and uncomfortable list of horrible things that Feanor and his sons have done in the name of their oath to pursue the Silmarils, this is the worst. What is it about this that makes it the worst? And I think this is another thing, actually, that I think is more explicit. The narrator is more explicit about this in the Book of Lost Tales, I think, than here. But I think we can still see the same thing. Matt, go ahead.
Well, my first comment is it's just all so much too little, too late. If they really wanted to get the Silmarils back, they wait to this 11th hour in this last desperate attempt to get the Silmaril, and it's all just kind of. It just seems more than pointless at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, I have to say, my favorite line from the Book of Lost Tales version is actually Dior. When the Sons of Feanor send their demand to Dior that he give them the Silmaril, Dior says to them, he's like, you know what? Morgoth still has two of them. Why don't y'all go up there and get them? You know, you're so keen on a Silmaril. They're right over there. Yeah, they're two. I've only got one. He's got two. Go for it, guys. Knock yourselves out. It's a phenomenal line that Dior gets. Obviously, I am paraphrasing it. But yeah, I mean, it's the pointlessness of it. Is really sad. But Dave, go ahead.
Well, in particular, I was going to focus on specifically his kids, whose names escape me at this moment. I feel like that was called to particular attention because they specifically say the cruel servants of... Ooh, which one was it? Was it Carinthir? Was it his cruel servants? Who basically
Caligorm.
took Dior's kids out, threw them in the woods, and let them starve.
Yeah, it was kind of...
I mean, I feel like that's... I mean, that's just... you know, it's one thing to slaughter innocent people. It's another thing to ensure that they die in a horrendous way that involves much... Like, I mean, that's a pretty proactive thing. They could have just, like, even cut the kids down when they found them. But instead, they grabbed them and then got on their horses, rode out into the middle of the woods, and dumped them. But just getting back into the language, this is one of the few times when I feel like we see an elf described in such a horrendously negative way. The mm-hmm. cruel servants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, Caligorm obviously comes off worst here. Caligorm is the one who stirs up his brothers to assault Doriath, and then he is the one where his servants are the ones who abandons little Elured and Elurine in the woods. Laura, go ahead. You wanted to add something here?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that this seems to be going above and beyond the oath, even, you know, killing innocent children. You know, what's really the point of that other than just cruelty?
Yeah, Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, I do think, and I would say in sort of in response, Dave, to what you were saying there, I would follow exactly what Laura said. You know, why is it that the death of those children is really singled out? Because I think the reason there's so much emphasis on that is it does serve as sort of the illustration, almost the symbol of what this whole thing is, of what they're doing there. It is completely pointless. And Laura's right. It's completely irrelevant to the oath. You know, the oath was that they will pursue with hatred anyone who keeps a Silmaril from them. So, okay, yes, fighting Dior is in line with the terms of the oath. I mean, the terms of the oath are horrible, but at least it's in line with it. His little boys are not doing them any, they're not keeping them. They're not standing in the way. They're standing between them and the Silmarils. Mike, go ahead.
It's kind of, I mean, when you think about it, when you put it into perspective of just elves in general, it's really an absurd exception. I mean, we see elves who are haughty, we see elves who are proud, we see elves who are wrathful, we see elves who become fey in their anger or their lust for revenge. These guys are like they've hit rock bottom for elves.
Yeah.
They've sunk into cruelty.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not even, you know, like just about every other sort of example of bad elf behavior that we've seen, it's not excusable or even necessarily relatable, but even like the Teleri, you know, that was, you're like, well, they got into a dispute and probably a couple guys got into a scuffle and then the whole thing erupted. But this is one of the greatest works of Morgoth. And actually, I would like to point that out, that what's fascinating about this chapter is it starts out talking about Morgoth and how the children of Húrin are dead. And then they go out of their way to say, but Morgoth wasn't done. He was still going to try and sow destruction.
Right.
And that his grudge against the descendants of Hador was not satiated. And then he lets Húrin go. And then we never hear about Morgoth again. And all we see are just the consequences of... I feel like we should be tying this back to Morgoth, that this is one of the truly awful things that Morgoth has accomplished in all of his conniving, that he has set circumstances up such that you have elves committing acts of blatant cruelty where there just doesn't even serve any purpose. They're just, I mean, they've become Morgoth, right? Like, I mean, that this is the sort of thing that he would have his servants do, and now the elves are doing it themselves to themselves.
Yeah, I think about Frodo's comment in Bag End at the end of the Return of the King. You know, this is Mordor. You know that it's the way that becomes internalized, and you've got someone like Saruman who was good and was perverted by Sauron, and was doing his work and everything, and you've got the Feanor and his sons in a similar kind of camp there.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of bizarre because the chapter starts talking about Morgoth, and then we never hear about him ever again.
Yeah.
It's just the rest of the chapter is people doing his work for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not even people it's people who ostensibly are his enemies.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Mike, you had wanted to say something before, I think.
Say, you know, Tolkien writing in this mode, we're not allowed to see the psychological motivations behind characters. But my guess is that Celegorm at this point hates himself, hates his father, hates the oath, is just a twisted entity at this point. And we don't get to know really psychologically where he is at this point in the story. But in writing in this mode, that's not appropriate. But what we get are his actions and the consequences or how he behaves. So that's got to be part of what's happened at this point.
Yeah, no, that's actually would be an interesting the comparison. What you've suggested there, sort of, that would be an interesting paper topic. Celegorm and Gollum, compare and contrast, discuss. I think that's as you say, we do have to be careful not to be kind of filling in too much of the sort of the internal backstory ourselves, but. But yeah, I mean, we've seen enough from Celegorm in particular, especially in the Baron and Luthien story. And remember, we also meet him in the story. He's the one who meets Aeol during the Maeglin story. He was the former master of Huon. I mean, really, Celegorm is one of the guys we've gotten to know best. So I think that's, yeah, it is certainly kind of tempting. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, that kind of set up my comment nicely there about, you know, parts of the Silmarillion are more fleshed out than others, and this is a really spare section. These three paragraphs could easily be an entire novel.
No, I agree. I mean, this is sort of like the, you know, that spareness of the Silmarillion, which is so characteristic of this whole book, in a pretty extreme form. By the way, the reference that I mentioned before, the way in which the narrator of the Lost Tales version is more explicit than the narrator finally in the Silmarillion, what he points to is premeditation as the primary difference, that this is the first premeditated slaying of elf by elf. Dave, just like the terms that you were suggesting before, the kinslaying was bad, but that was like second degree murder. You know, they didn't go in there planning to kill them. Here, they are planning and premeditating. We're going to go in and we're going to kill, our fellow elves. That's never happened before. We haven't seen anybody do that. I think that's clearly a big deal. And as we've been saying, the abandonment of the kids is sort of the worst illustration of that. Well, not that we talked about everything in this chapter, but I think we've gone through a lot of it. We did not, of course, talk about the intervention of Treebeard and the Ents. I say Treebeard. He's not mentioned by name, of course, but given the fact that Treebeard talks about his fond memories of Beleriand and his time in Osiriand, which is where that fight happens, I think it is to me utterly inconceivable that Treebeard was not there fighting with Beren against the dwarves there. But I think that it's perfectly acceptable that we didn't say much about them, because what I said just now was more than we got about them in the chapter, speaking of the spareness that you were talking about, Matt. Matt, go ahead.
Do you think this is one of the memories that he's recalling fondly?
No, I don't, but I do think...
I remember the good old days when we slaughtered dwarves up in the hills. Yes, yeah. Those were the good old days.
I do think that it's what he's thinking, though, when Gimli bows and his axe falls out of his belt and he says, a dwarf and an axe wielder. Yeah, that's totally what he's thinking about there. But Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, this is just one other quick comment. I mean, there's very few happy endings in this book. One of which is Beren and Luthien granted some more time together, but it just kind of killed it for me when I read that it's where they dwell is referred to as the land of the dead that live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. The land of the dead that doesn't have to mean like the land of the zombies, right? It means like the land of the resurrected people, the land of resurrection. But it certainly does seem to point to the kind of etherealness, the kind of numinousness of this. Clearly, nobody really knows what to do with them. That is, nobody really knows how to relate to them. Beren and Luthien are kind of operating on a different level at this point. And that seems pretty clear to everybody around them, it seems. But I think that... Therefore, the arrival of the Silmaril and the Nauglamir here, you know, Luthien wearing the Nauglamir with the Silmaril is the greatest vision of loveliness ever. I mean, she was already the most beautiful of the children of Iluvatar, and now you've got the most beautiful of the children of Iluvatar adorned by the greatest work of the greatest and most beautiful craftsmanship of both the dwarves and the elves combined. This is sort of, you know, then the quintessential beauty which hallows the land and makes it a mystery. I mean, it makes normal mortals and even normal elves sort of uncomfortable about it and shunning it. And I think, especially thinking as much as we did about Tol Morwen and the Grave of the Hapless, I think it's interesting and significant that we don't know exactly where Beren and Luthien's tomb is. And so perhaps one of the really interesting and significant grave sites that we get here in the Silmarillion is the lack of a grave site of Beren and Luthien. And the fact that they just kind of disappear in this way is I think the fitting end to Beren and Luthien. They don't have a memorial other than this mysterious land, this sort of fairyland within fairyland, this land of wonder and mystery, you know, which grows around them because they live there. That's the monument, and the memory of that is the monument. Okay, well, I should let everybody go. We are over time, thanks everybody for another fun discussion. We are almost done with A Quenta Silmarillion. We've got Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin next week, and then off to Eärendil and the War of Wrath. We're really getting there. Thanks everybody.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.